Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
A Radio Info Raw Edit podcast. The conversations behind our reports.
After a very long and successful career as a foreign correspondent with BBC, most recently as the New York correspondent, Nick Wright and his family are now here in Australia, and he's just launched a brand new podcast. It's called Journo, in association with the Judith Nielsen Institute. First of all, why Australia?
Why Australia? Because it's a lifestyle superpower of the world. And my wife is Australian. My two kids are Australian. They both have emus and kangaroos on their passports. And we really always wanted to raise them here, to be honest. We left Australia when they were very young. We went to live in America for 8 years. But always the intention was to come back at some stage. And it just seemed to work for everybody in the family. The kids were at the right age. My wife had inherited a business here, actually, that she wanted to come back and run. It was hard to run from afar. And also for me, I mean, I ended up finishing the Trump years. And on the night that Joe Biden was inaugurated, and I was on the inaugural stand, I was about 50 yards away from him as he took the oath of office, I just thought I'd done my dash. I just thought, I've covered the most extraordinary political story that I'll ever cover. I mean, if Donald Trump comes back, which is a possibility that we can't rule out, that would be an amazing story, but not as remarkable as his rise and not as remarkable as the first term of his presidency. And I just thought that was a good time to bow out. And as I say, it just worked for everybody to come back to Australia at that stage.
I love the story about the fact that your book, When America Stopped Being Great, is on Biden's bookshelf.
Well, look, when you write a book about America and its current malaise, you know, you really want to have an influential readership, don't you? And, you know, extraordinarily, you know, one of my Twitter followers actually saw a photograph of Biden in the Oval Office, and she noticed that my book, When America Stopped Being Great, A History of the President, was right behind him, underneath his son's book, Hunter Biden's book. And it was a small stack. It was only a couple of books there. So, yeah, I hope he is learning from it, really. And it's odd because we thought he'd mention the book, actually, a couple of months ago. I'd been on a show called Morning Joe, a very influential political show in America, MSNBC. And maybe Joe Biden had it on in the background while he was shaving, because later that day he referred to what we thought was my book. We were 90% sure it was my book. And then a couple of months later, we saw the book had actually made it into the Oval Office. Yeah, that was a nice moment.
Does that mean that the copy of the Australian one, The Rise and the Fall of Australia, is that ScoMo, has he got that on his bookshelf, do you think?
Well, that's a great question. Has it made it into the lodge? Has it made it into the Prime Minister's office on Parliament Hill? I don't know. I doubt it, because it's not very complimentary about Australian politics. I mean, I always argue that this is a great nation with a pretty average politics. And, you know, I wrote that 8 years ago, but I think the thesis still holds up. I mean, arguably the thesis has really been underscored by recent events.
It's an interesting place to be, sitting outside and looking at politics in this country. It can be particularly entertaining at times, and I'm not sure that politics ought to be entertaining. I think one of the great problems with it is that it's like journalism, I think, to a certain extent. I'm not sure that too much that journalists these days don't want to be entertainers more than observers.
Look, I think that's a really good point. I mean, presidencies and prime ministerships aren't there for our journalistic entertainment value. And sometimes I think we sort of judge them by that standard. So we say that leaders are boring when actually they're being quite effective, but they're just not particularly good showmen. And I think, you know, we do look for the people who give us entertainment. We do look for people who give us the most interesting storylines. And, you know, that was very noticeable in the rise of Donald Trump in 2016. I mean, the attention that we as journalists lavished on Donald Trump, because we knew it was just an extraordinary story. I speak in my book, When America Stopped Being Great, about how often bias in journalism isn't a liberal bias or a conservative bias. It's what I call a better story bias. We write stories that comport with the stories that really we want to cover. So we really want an exciting presidential race. We really want an extraordinary presidential race. And of course, when Donald Trump pops up, he was the guy that gave us both.
So we look at the presidency now, and we look at what's happening here in Australia and look at it. Does it give you a different outlook being outside of having to report on it on a daily basis?
I'm really glad to be out of day-to-day news. I won't go back into that. That's the end for me in terms of covering news in that manner. But what I do want to do is take a step back and think about things more deeply and look for the things that create the political weather rather than just reporting on the weather, giving the weather forecast every day or the weather report every day. You know, it's thinking about what makes that weather. And so I'm still going to keep writing. I'm still going to keep thinking. I won't be doing day to day, as I've said. But I want to sort of take a step back, really. I mean, that's what I did in the book. I really sort of wanted to try and make sense of Donald Trump. And that was a 50-year journey and a 50-year look back, a prehistory of his presidency. And, I want to take a sort of broader look at what's happening rather than, you know, the nitty-gritty of the day-to-day.
So the podcast journal that you started with the Judith Nielsen Institute, and the first episode came out yesterday, and it's about Afghan and the Taliban, really interesting to listen to, and I recommend it to anybody. It's a fascinating situation. How do you see it unfolding in Afghanistan?
Well, it's really worrying. I mean, what we report on in the first episode of journal is how, as international correspondents rushed to Kabul as the Taliban continued its rapier advance, hundreds of Afghan journalists were heading in the opposite direction. When we were looking at those planes taking off from Kabul airport, unfortunately, lots of Afghan local journalists were on board. Many feared for their lives. Many decided to flee the country. And what we've seen is the decimation already of a generation of Afghan journalists that really came to the fore after 9/11. In fact, some of them even got involved inadvertently after 9/11. We tell the story of an old mate of mine, Bilal Sawari. He was selling carpets and antique furniture in a luxury hotel in Peshawar in Pakistan when 9/11 happened. His hotel was absolutely inundated with foreign journalists. They were looking for people to translate. Bilal was Afghan-born. So he joined a news team as they sort of crossed the border into Afghanistan. And so began this really stellar and extraordinary career. I mean, he really is regarded as one of the best journalists in Afghanistan. But alas, he was told by a friend, actually, in the Taliban, somebody who he'd gone to school with, that his life was in danger and he needed to get out. And somebody who loves Afghanistan, loves their homeland, you decided they had no other choice but to head to the airport and to leave the country with his wife and young child. And we tell Bilal's story and we tell the story of others who have left and people who are still there operating under the most difficult and draconian and authoritarian and brutal circumstances.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's a great concern about, of course, female journalists now in Afghanistan. And I think I saw on the news today there's some concern on the Taliban now having banned women from playing sport, and one of the tests has now been cancelled, with the men deciding that they're not going to play either in protest to it. So the situation there is certainly not going to get any better. Do we really think that the Taliban has changed all that much? They're certainly better at socials than they've been before.
Yeah, their media operation is very slick. It's very savvy. There is this school of thought that thinks one of the reasons why they won the war in Afghanistan was because they won the information war. They were just far more agile than the Afghan government, and at times far more agile than the US military in telling a story, putting out a story, verifying stories. And I mean, that was something sort of I was fascinated by doing this episode, was to see how sophisticated the Taliban has become in its use of the media. I mean, I reported from Afghanistan in 2003 to 2006, and you know, it was the new Afghan authorities that really were the kind of the slick media operators. And actually, you know, 15 years on, it's the Taliban. And that is quite extraordinary. But, you know, for all their sort of protestations about saying we're different, we're new, we're going to be far more helpful to the press. I mean, you know, obviously from what we're seeing on the streets, it's a very different story. I mean, we've seen journalists beaten up already, thrashed, journalists intimidated. And I think that's going to be the reality of reporting in the new Afghanistan.
So leaving Afghanistan behind for the time being, and as I say, I recommend the podcast, the first in the series of Journo. It's a fascinating listen. But looking forward to what's coming up, so what subjects are you going to be covering or you're hoping to cover?
I think the next episode is going to be about China and a similar problem, an exodus of journalists actually forced to leave by the Chinese authorities. Of course, Australia has been bearing the brunt of that. You know, you had Michael Smith of the Australian Financial Review and Bill Birtles of the ABC who were told they had to go. And that has been also the experience of a lot of American news organizations like the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the BBC's correspondent, John Subworth, who's done a lot of work about the Uyghurs and these camps that are run by the Chinese. He decided that he had to flee the country and he dashed to Taiwan. And what the Chinese are doing now is using visas really to sort of put a lot of pressure on international journalists, short-term visas that can be cancelled really easily. I guess in the hope that journalists will self-censor, they won't sort of do many reports that are overtly critical of the Chinese government. But as you know, I mean, if you're going to do your job properly in China, you need to report those stories. So we're facing this Chinese catch-22 where in order to do your jobs properly, actually ends up getting you thrown out of the country.
So that brings me to another question then about journalism and the difference between community journalism and social commentators.
I think it's fascinating. And that's actually something we're going to return to later in the series. I think episode 4 is actually going to be about this very subject: local journalism, regional journalism, community journalism, hyper-local journalism, because it's a real problem, obviously. I mean, I've come from America where, you know, some of the famous old regional newspapers and local newspapers just don't exist anymore. And that vacuum has often been filled by, you know, local people who don't have, you know, high journalistic standards, who often are people who are putting out misinformation on social media, on their Twitter feeds and on Facebook. It's worth saying there are some really great community radio stations that are absolutely top-notch when it comes to putting out accurate and truthful information. And one of the interesting things in the wildfires, for instance, is sometimes these community radio stations really come to the fore. I mean, we often think in Australia about the role of local radio from the ABC in wildfire situations, who obviously do a brilliant and fantastic job. But there have been situations, we understand, where actually, because the community radio has an even better understanding of their locale, they can actually give even better advice when it comes to road closures, for instance, or, you know, they may get the pronunciation of something absolutely spot on in a way that, you know, some local presenter in Melbourne or somewhere might not. And it's been shown that often, you know, people are relying on community radio in these wildfire situations and the bushfire situations rather than local radio, even though ABC does such a brilliant job.
It was an interesting thing that happened yesterday. The High Court, I don't know whether you saw it, has ruled that news outlets now are legally responsible for comments left on their Facebook page. Now, I don't know whether you're aware, but there was a young youth detainee up in the Northern Territory who sued both News Corp and Nine for defamatory comments that were made on their Facebook page in 2018. Now, that's a very interesting step and an interesting ruling that the High Court's made. How much of a problem do you think that's going to be for news organisations?
absolutely massive. And it's an absolute game changer, I think. And news organizations must have been terrified. I mean, given how much traffic these days comes through Facebook, you know, you had this controversy, obviously, earlier in the year with Australia in battle with Facebook over this very thing. And if news organizations are going to be responsible for the comments left on Facebook, then it's going to be very difficult for them to publish those stories with that kind of facility to comment, I think, because it's just so hard to regulate and so hard to moderate. And I just don't see how they can do it quickly enough to protect themselves legally. So the ramifications of this, I think are massive.
They are indeed. Look, thanks for your time today. Thanks for your insight on that. I'm really looking forward to the rest of the series, Journo. We hope you enjoy your time here in Australia. You're pretty much out of quarantine and into lockup. So, yeah, I'm guessing you haven't seen all that much, but you left behind a pretty nice place. I mean, you're in Dumbo in New York, which is one of those places I kind of like. I've wandered around there, you know, I've been into Gleason's gym, and is it the Jacques Torres chocolate shop and down to the carousel. It's a pretty area.
Wow, you're making me homesick for New York. Some of my favorite things about Dumbo, yeah. I mean, Gleason's gym is one of the most famous boxing gyms in New York. Jack Torres chocolate is my kid's favorite. The carousel is where we used to put the kids on the carousel on a Sunday afternoon. No, it's a lovely spot. But I, like I said at the beginning, I mean, Australia really is something special when it comes to lifestyle, when it comes to the quality of life. I'm really thankful for what you said about Journo. I'm really proud of it. I think it's amazing that the team that's put it together has never met. We've never been in the same room together. We put the first episode together while I was in quarantine, and it shows what you can do these days with technology. But even with that, it was a big ask, and I think that the team has actually performed heroics in getting, you know, what I think is a sort of compelling story onto air.
I think you have too. Good luck with it. I really do hope it goes well, and enjoy your time in the country again. Well, happy around about mid-October you get out and get to see a little bit more. Nick Bryan, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.